Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
This is Reaganism, podcast dedicated to exploring Reaganism, what it means, and where we find it today. Our guest today is Dan Twining. He's president of IRI, the International Republican Institute. He is a former foreign policy advisor to Senator John McCain, a long career in the world of foreign policy and democracy promotion with impressive degrees from impressive places. He's been an advisor on presidential campaigns, but most notably for our conversation today, Dan is a participant in the Reagan Institute essay series on presidential principles and beliefs, where he wrote a really fantastic essay analyzing President Reagan's famous Westminster Address, which Dan titled, "Then as Now, America's Security is Tied to the Fate of Free Peoples." So you are the president of the International Republican Institute. Give us some background on how the NED and IRI were founded. The Reagan connection, of course, goes right to the heart of the Westminster Address. And then, of course, just tell us about your work.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you. So the National Endowment for Democracy was set up by Ronald Reagan and the Congress in 1983. His vision was that the way America and the free world would win the Cold War against Soviet tyranny was to project our democratic universal values. The Reagan insight was that all people everywhere want freedom and dignity and relief from government oppression, and that America and the West had not really used that advantage in a Cold War that had focused so much on kind of military competition. And so he set up the National Endowment for Democracy with the Congress, and IRI, the National Republican Institute, which I now lead, is a core institute of the NED that works around the world to support democracy and human freedom.
So we're going to get into all of that. But Reagan, of course, the great communicator, really believed in stories and conveying major ideas and principles through a story. Give us a sense of how a story kind of impacts you and drives your thinking and the way you present the work of IRI.
So there are a couple. You know, we talk about democracy and human rights at a very high level. But in fact, the impact comes from how it affects individuals. So I've got lots of stories, but one that I remember vividly because it was so different is I was in Nigeria in the headquarters of a political party last year. And we had worked with this Nigerian political party, whose president is now running the country, to help them diversify the steering committee of that political party. Because when we began engaging with them, it was a bunch of older men. And we said, this country is predominantly made up of women, young people. There are also all these marginalized groups. There are millions and millions of handicapped Nigerians. This country has no infrastructure to support all of their needs. And so I was on the top floor. I was on the seventh floor of a building with no elevator. And we're in this political party HQ meeting. And in the middle of it, this guy waddles in. He has no legs. Okay? And he's like riding on something that looks like a homemade skateboard. And he said, I had to come up and meet you, because I am the disabled rep for my political party. I'm now on the steering committee, and there are tens of millions of Nigerians like me who have no voice, who had no voice until you all helped do some inclusion with my political party leadership. And the thing about it that most struck me is that he had come up seven flights of stairs on his hands, right? And he just said, I had to come and meet you. And he was sweating, right, and he was 45 minutes late, and he had spent all of that time coming up.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, right? It's for an American.
It's not just about monitoring an election there. I mean, you're talking about something much deeper.
We're talking about having politics in countries that reflects the aspirations of their people. And, you know, we see it all over the world, which is that people want the same things. I was observing elections in Pakistan in 2013, and I think for many Americans, we have an idea that Pakistan is full of terrorists and extremists. So we went way out in the sticks, in the boonies, in the middle of nowhere, and there were these long, long lines, all these people voting. And I felt perfectly safe. And so I was talking to all these people in these long lines, and there was an old man with a young kid on his shoulders, and he said, American, American, I want you to see this. I brought my grandson so he could understand that we get to choose our country's leaders. Mm-hmm. And I said, so what do you want? And this old Pakistani man said, I want my son to have a job and an education, and I want to live in a democracy where politicians don't steal from the public. That's what I want.
Huge aspirations.
And actually, you hear that all over the world. People all want similar things.
So we're going to get into a lot of that, particularly focus on elections and then what you get and how you deal with those who you're elected and how that impacts freedom and democracy. But you talk about aspirations and realizing those aspirations. And of course, we interfered with your life, your professional aspirations, by asking you to write an essay on President Reagan's Westminster speech. You spoke about the NED and IRI, and that all took place in 1983. But of course, it grew out of Reagan's Westminster address in 1982, which was a seminal moment for the democracy movement, the freedom movement, and really, I think, in the Cold War. You hit on that a little bit at the outset. Just take us back there. Why is President Reagan speaking in London, and what are the goals for that address? You know, we're kind of going to go in and unpack much of, of what the president said.
But so the context is quite interesting, because looking back, we think, well, gosh, Reagan, you know, he won the Cold War. It all ended 7 years later. Freedom and democracy prevailed. Europe whole and free. The world didn't look that way in 1982. In fact, America was coming out of a very bad decade, really a bad decade and a half, right? The assassination of political leaders and civil unrest in the late 60s, kind of unprecedented since the Civil War. The 70s, stagflation, all the malaise that Jimmy Carter self-diagnosed. A sense in the strategic community, including Henry Kissinger and that crowd, that the Soviets were winning, right? There wasn't a sense that America was winning.
Détente was a reflection of something we had to kind of live with it,
yes,
right?
A reflection of a self-perception of American weakness. So here comes Ronald Reagan saying, actually, I can see how the Soviet Union will end, and it will end the way all other totalitarian societies have ended. Its people will want something more. They will not want to live under this kind of political oppression. And he cast a vision of a world that was free and democratic and pluralistic. And at the time, people thought it was kind of a joke. There were lots of people in his own administration in the White House who thought he was being naive and totally optimistic. There were people in the strategic community who wondered what on earth he was talking about when he said, we're going to run a global campaign to build an infrastructure of democracy. And he essentially forecast through his optimism exactly how the Cold War would end, which was without a shot being fired, without a war being fought, but with citizens of the Soviet Empire deciding to liberate themselves. And that vision goes right back to Reagan.
And you're talking about today, just quick question, and then I want to go into your essay and some of the basic arguments, but something you hit on, which is kind of the establishment, some who just, you know, the people who have been doing this before you got here will be doing this after you leave. It's being so skeptical and critical of any attempt, really, these kind of idyllic notions are somehow going to be the key ingredient to defeating the Soviet Union. I mean, do you find that in your work today, that you're dismissed by the serious policymaker and people who exercise the tool of statecraft, that this democracy and freedom stuff is child's play?
So a couple things. One is that I think after the Cold War, a lot of Americans, a lot of leaders, a lot of officials supported promoting democracy and human freedom because the field was wide open, right? Soviet Empire had collapsed. People everywhere had risen up. Globalization was on the march. It kind of felt like our moment. It feels like a very different moment now. We have genuine strategic competition from China and Russia of a kind we haven't had certainly since the Cold War, so for 30 years. I'm finding actually a lot of American officials, strategists who don't come out of the democracy and human rights community are actually coming to it almost through the back door, because they understand that if America is going to compete in this very fraught and dangerous world that we are now in, we have to use the full spectrum of our influence. And just like Russia and China are using sharp power, non-military instruments to attack and weaken and corrode democracies, we as Americans have to support democracy in the world, because this is the source of our military alliances. I mean, our greatest allies are all democracies. This is the source of our moral and strategic leadership in the world. People all over the world expect us to stand up for these things.
So, you know, almost like the competition has crystallized for people. And then what I'm hearing you say is that in your work today, you're getting people interested who in the past either weren't, ignored, or otherwise felt there were more important things to focus on. We're going to get to sharp power a bit, because that's one of the terms you use in your essay. But let's take a step back. Your essay, as part of our Reagan Institute series on presidential beliefs and principles is titled Then as Now, America's Security is Tied to the Fate of Free Peoples. Just run us through the contours and arguments in your essay.
So basically, and this is beyond just my essay, American leaders have always understood that American democracy could not be safe in a world of hostile autocracies. Actually, if you read the Federalist Papers, Hamilton and Madison and Jefferson and others were quite consumed, George Washington, with this idea that this tiny little democratic republic would be in danger in a world of imperial autocracies based in Europe. Fast forward through the 19th century to the 20th century, American leaders, FDR, Eisenhower, JFK, through Reagan, understood that America could not simply be an isolationist kind of fortress America in the Western Hemisphere, that if authoritarian powers took over Europe and Asia, our very way of life at home would be imperiled, right? And that's sort of the situation we're in today. It's not as dire. Obviously, there isn't an imperial Japan invading Asian islands. There's not a Nazi army marching across Europe.
No, they're building islands now.
Right.
We're not invading islands. We're just building them.
But the point is that Americans, we do have a tendency just to want to kind of mind our own business. But the problem is that our economic and political fate is actually tied to these very strategic regions. And we need democratic allies to work with us in those regions so that hostile autocracies who want to weaken us do not control those regions.
So we'll get to the domestic side and domestic preferences and probably one of the major challenges I think we have in effectuating what you call for. But you have these parallels between 1982, the Westminster speech, and 2019 today. You outlined in your article, your essay here, one thing that really stands out to me is your reference to Freedom House, like a survey.
In 1982.
Just describe for our listeners, our thousands and thousands of listeners, Dan, what the 1982 Freedom House, Freedom in the World survey looked like in 1982, and then move us to 2019. I thought it was a really provocative, interesting way to just put it in perspective.
Okay, so in 1982, Freedom House, which judges the quality of democracy in every country in the world, basically had less than 20 democracies in the world it identified. Most of the world, it had a kind of a color-coded map of the world.
It was,
most of the world was
free,
black. Most of the world was black,
right.
Including essentially all the Middle East except Israel, including all of Africa except Botswana, including, you know, Latin America, many military dictatorships were still in charge.
Venezuela
was a democracy, it turns out, in 1982. Think about countries from Pakistan to Indonesia to South Korea to Taiwan. They were not democracies. They were run by military dictators. The world looked so different in 1982. And comparing that to today, you know, I know we're going to talk more about this, but there's this sense that democracy is in retreat. Democracy is playing defense in the world. Democracy is in decline. Strong men are on the march everywhere. Today, you have over 100 real democracies in the world. Those strategic gains from the end of the Cold War and then the expansion of that wave of democracy in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia. We're looking at a totally different democratic landscape today. And I think what confuses people is that democracy doesn't solve all your problems. Democracy doesn't create heaven on earth. It's still a messy thing to run a country, right? What democracy does is it prevents civil war, it prevents rule by mobs, and it protects individual rights, including minority rights. And it creates a peaceful way for political transitions to occur.
Yeah.
But so the world of today, I mean, I think we all do have a sense of being besieged and under assault. But in fact, in 1982, when Reagan gave this speech, we actually really were besieged.
When I read it, your essay, your excellent essay, which we're excited to post on the Reagan Institute website in the near future here, it showed that the trajectory here, right, if you contextualize it and you use 1982 as a baseline, when Reagan goes out and delivers this address in Westminster, and then you look at where we are and you just took us through it, I mean, yes, we got to talk about the backsliding, and we will, and the challenges, and we have to make sure it doesn't become reverse it.
Sure.
But the trend is one where it's in a great direction in terms of democracies and increase the number of free people around the world. The other piece in there, which I thought was interesting, you embedded in your paragraph as you referenced 1982, was America and American strength. Take us through, we'll get to the kind of people's views of democracy promotion overseas, the electorate, the American people, but just America's sense of itself and its strength. When Reagan's saying this in 1982, it wasn't as if, what does our president call it? We have this great economy, right? Mm-hmm. It was hard to, we had tax cuts that were going in place, but the full effect hadn't been felt. And then compare that today.
Yes.
So I wouldn't want to comment on that, just kind of Americans' confidence and economic strength and otherwise.
So, I mean, I'll never forget my parents who bought a house in this period in the early 80s, and they had like a 17% mortgage, yeah, right? Because interest rates, I mean, inflation was double digits in the early 80s. So the U.S. had fought this war in Vietnam, which had left many Americans alienated because we could not win and did not win. We had gone through this period of stagflation in the late 70s. Stagflation is high inflation and very slow economic growth. America looked like it was underperforming. Now, the Soviet Union, it turns out, was really underperforming. Right. I mean, this was like the bottom was dropping out of the Soviet economy in the 80s. We hadn't fully figured that out yet. But, you know, it tracks very directly with some of the debate today that the Chinese totalitarian system has discovered a superior model, one in which you can produce high rates of economic growth that lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And by the way, according to the Chinese leadership, those people really don't care about political rights and freedom. They just, you know, we put money in their pockets and they're happy. It turns out when you look at Hong Kong today that very rich Chinese, the richest Chinese live in Hong Kong, right? Per capita incomes as high as Germany and France and other European countries, that the richest Chinese are some of the most unhappy. Bloomberg did a survey showing that almost half of wealthy Chinese have plans or want to emigrate. They want to leave China. Okay. There's no other country in the world that I know of that has a sophisticated economy where half of those top two percenters want to leave the country permanently.
Okay, so we're going to get to all of that, particularly the China piece and that amazing point, which Reagan hit on. We'll get the quote in here at some point, but you make a point in your essay, then is now, no citizen flees a justly governed democracy. We're going to come back to that. But back in 82, you have that freedom map, you have high inflation, you know, and yet Reagan is seeing like optimism and the democratic revolution is gathering new strength. You know, there's this instinctive desire for freedom and self-determination. And I'm reading this, I'm like, was it really there? He obviously was on to something. But then we look at today, right? And that perhaps is a big difference. I mean, could you honestly say, Dan, that 2019 is a 1982 moment from the standpoint of the promise for people seeking democracy and that optimism that Reagan saw in 82? You know, we have reason to share the same optimism now. And I'll add to that, I ask you to work in your response, Larry Diamond's recent piece in Foreign Affairs. We're going really highbrow here, by the way. You know, we're talking about a Foreign Affairs article by Larry Diamond. But he's a, you know, colleague of yours, you know, at the NED. And he wrote this article in the most recent edition, How the Freedom Agenda Fell Apart. You know, he calls it democracy demotion. So he's not ready to give a Westminster 2.0 speech today. And so that parallel perhaps is one that, you know, doesn't apply.
So there are a couple things that are happening here. One is that I think the quote-unquote freedom agenda that George W. Bush outlined gets confused in people's minds with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which were not wars for freedom, because one does not invade a country to produce a democracy is the primary determinant. Those were wars, right? Those were wars made on national security decision grounds that had very little to do with democracy. The broader point, though, so democracy support is a peaceful enterprise conducted by NGOs, right? It's not something conducted by, like, the 1st Marine Brigade. That's the first point. The second point is that Larry Diamond sort of assesses that American leadership is lacking and that, therefore, democracy is slipping in the world. Now, I'd like to come back to that. But really, what is so inspiring to me is that people are in the streets all over the world, in Venezuela, in Sudan, in Algeria, in Hong Kong. It actually doesn't have a lot to do with us. They're certainly not doing it for America.
Right, right.
Or, you know, the Chinese leadership said, oh, foreign forces are creating all this unrest in Hong Kong. Really, it has nothing to do with us. It's all about these people's aspirations, these
to
incredibly
mobilize,
brave people.
You know, 100,000 people, let alone millions. That's impressive.
This
right?
is not in America's power. And as you know, our political leadership is focused on very different things than doing that. So what is happening out there is that very brave people are risking their lives and sometimes dying for the principles that Reagan outlined in his speech and that Americans believe, America's founding principles, right? We don't have to call it the freedom agenda. It doesn't have to be led by the United States. In fact, we know on the basis of world history that these freedoms are something that people want and America should stand with them and be on their side.
So let me do something I shouldn't do, which is I'm going to stand in the shoes of Larry Diamond and push back a bit on that so you can get a little deeper and get some of the complexity. The freedom agenda I think he's referencing is what the U.S. foreign policy pursued starting with Bush 41, following the fall of the Soviet Union. And yes, you've offered evidence of people taking the streets seeking that freedom that we enjoy here and we want for others and we think is an inherent right for all people. Yet the places where democracy grew out of the fall of the Soviet Union, particularly in Eastern Europe, is a very backsliding that Larry's talking about. So on the one hand, yes, we have places where people are suing freedom. In other places, these democratic governments, you know, are now falling into this liberal democracy category. So address what's happening there.
Yeah.
Because okay. That's the challenge.
So Central and Eastern Europe is quite a mixed picture. I mean, democracy is doing very well in countries like Slovakia, right? So I think the countries you're really talking about are Hungary and Poland.
Which is what he cites.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple things. One is that I think we as Americans historically have underestimated the legacy of dictatorship. You saw this for sure in Iraq after 2003. Mm-hmm. Where we went in thinking we could help build civilian institutions, accountability, political transparency. It turns out that being run as a authoritarian or totalitarian system for many decades, as Hungary and Poland were under the Soviet grip, that coming out of that is very difficult. That democracy doesn't just sort of blossom in a day, right? I mean, Reagan talks about it's a fragile flower, mm-hmm. It needs to be nurtured. It's not like you just pour some quick start in the soil and suddenly you've got your field of sunflowers. So what you see is this constant struggle, and it runs through the heart of every human being between good and evil. And you see this constant struggle at play in a democratic system, just like you see it at play elsewhere. And in a country like Hungary, what has happened is essentially a leader took office through democratic means and then used executive power to hollow out countervailing institutions. Mm-hmm. The courts, the media, the parliament, right? You're seeing less of this in Poland. Actually, I was in Poland twice in the last 6 months. And on my previous visit last fall, the ruling party has about 40% support, the government of the country. The opposition, when I was there last fall, had just won the mayoralties of the 10 biggest cities in Poland. So you still have real pluralism and diversity going on there. You still have genuine political competition. In Hungary, part of the problem has been EU's response to the migrant crisis, right? That Angela mm-hmm. Merkel led 1 million refugees into Germany. This open borders debate, Viktor Orban, the leader of Hungary, has taken that and frankly used it in populist nationalist style. To get reelected and to consolidate his political control. And the last thing I'll say about a country like Hungary, you also see, have seen it in Turkey with Erdogan, is that...
Is it Erdogan or Erdogan? You seem to be very confident with your Erdogan pronunciation. We'll go with that. Okay.
But what I think is visible is not visible above the surface is that often in these societies, in these strongman societies, there is a direct nexus with big business and kind of oligarchic interests. You've seen this in countries like Ukraine, where actually the ruling party and the leader, actually, it turns out they become quite prosperous well beyond their means.
System's rigged?
Yes.
The system's rigged?
That essentially you hollow out democratic institutions so that you can control political power, so that you can enrich yourself and your cronies. And by the way, this is exactly what Vladimir Putin has done in Russia like times 20.
Right. So we're going to move to China in a second, but let's finish out our discussion on Larry Diamond's piece. And you've highlighted as what's going on in terms of the democratic, you know, the backsliding and what is being referred to as the liberal democracies. You talk about this hollowing out. Right? And you have democratically elected leaders, no dispute there, that's an accomplishment. But then they do illiberal things in office, that's a challenge, right? You're going to lose points in your Freedom House rating. Do we have the tools, Dan, in place to help with this, to assist with this? So IRAD is amazing work. The entities that the NED supports, fantastic. That was built, as you referenced at the beginning here, in 1983. We're talking about 40 years ago. So do we need an update? Before you respond, I'll just say Larry highlights the U.S. Information Agency and kind of regrets that it was defunded, and, you know, the usual target for this stuff is Jesse Helms, and he figures in his article and, you know, all that. It struck me as, well, that's not just kind of rehashing something from the old playbook. I don't see it as particularly attractive, but the question I think is strong. Do we have the right tools to deal with quote-unquote the legacy of dictatorship? What more can we offer from an infrastructure and support standpoint to address this hollowing out?
It's a great question. Most of our development assistance, and we have a very generous foreign assistance budget, so there's not a resource
problem. Don't say that so loud. Appropriators may be listening.
It's generous in the sense that it reflects America's interests in a more stable and peaceful and prosperous world.
I clearly
world.
Irritated Dan with that
but,
question
no,
here.
But, so my argument is not that we need to like quadruple the foreign aid budget.
Right.
I just think politically that's a very difficult thing to do. I would argue for spending the money a bit differently, spending a lot more of it supporting democracy, good governance, civil society, free media, independent courts out in the world. We spend most of our foreign assistance budget, frankly, on like humanitarian band-aid solutions for desperate people fleeing desperate situations. But instead of addressing the conflicts at the source, we only treat the symptoms, right? Venezuelan refugees, Syrian refugees, Rohingya refugees in Burma, whatever it may be, we are not doing enough to address the reason these people are fleeing. Central American migrants who live in gangster societies where they feel at huge personal risk and have no opportunity for a better future, they're racing to cross America's borders, which is a problem for us. So investing at the source, nobody actually wakes up in a stable, successful society and thinks, I gotta grab my wife and children and get out of here and go to another country and never come home, right? No one wants to do that. People do that because they feel like they have no hope. And so coming back to your very important question, we need to update the toolkit of how we think about American engagement in the world that is not military engagement. And I would argue for more support for helping countries build successful societies so that people don't flee, so that Chinese and Russian authoritarian malign influence doesn't come in and capture those countries, so that corrupt oligarchic criminals don't seize political power in those countries and delegitimize democracy, as we were discussing earlier, has happened in some hollowed out democracies. And again, from an American national security perspective, we are much safer when our democratic allies are strong, when the world is more free and more open and more prosperous.
All right, so we have Senator Leahy and Senator Shelby at the table, and they'll say, great, let's do it. We're going to appropriate funds for this. Don't worry about the American people. We'll handle that. Do you think there are places to invest to do the things you've described?
Yes.
I mean, there's infrastructure there. There's tools that we're just not exercising.
So we have various broadcasters, Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Liberty. These were created in different times.
Sounds kind of old.
The Voice of America. No, but yeah. Let's recast them for a new world where everybody uses digital technologies, where everybody is plugged in, where the point is not to propagandize about American values, but actually is to do things like highlight corrupt practice, to highlight cases where authoritarians have come in and taken over, to highlight the benefits of an open system.
So you kind of like, I mean, that's where Larry ends up. I mean, he quotes Edward Murrow, who was a director of USIA under Kennedy, and said, you know, his quote is, truth is the best propaganda and lies are the worst. Is that what you're suggesting we need to do more of?
I mean, I think I'd probably be more edgy. And this is, I have other recommendations in the information space. But in the information space, look, Russia, through disinformation and all of its nefarious activities on social media, is using information as a weapon. China is using information in very subtle and sharp ways to build out an expanding sphere of Chinese influence that weakens and corrodes democracy and weakens American leadership. So if authoritarian competitors are using information for those negative ends, why can't we use information for more positive purposes, right? I mean, they understand that the information domain is a contested space. It feels like America is simply playing defense.
Let's jump into China. We've hit on it a few times in the conversation so far. You keep on using this word of sharp tool. Talk about that, what you mean by that, how it's being employed, deployed, but then also this notion of systems, right? And how it's a component of, in the case of China, advancing what I think you view as a competition of systems. I'm going to push back on that a little bit. But this idea that, hey, you know what? People are going to give up their freedom, their liberty, their democracy, because I'm going to give them security and prosperity. And look at the United States, or look at democracies elsewhere around the world. You know, they can't give you security. They're failing on the prosperity. So what good does a so-called freedom is? In the end of the day, if you don't have security, you don't have freedom. Did I characterize that correctly? And take me through the competition as you see it in terms of systems and how we're measuring up.
So it's a complicated question. Sharp power is a term the National Endowment of Democracy popularized to explain what China and Russia are up to in terms of using state instruments to project influence in non-military ways.
Not soft power, not hard power.
It's not soft power, because soft power is something that doesn't come from governments. It emanates from society. So like Hollywood is an example of American soft power, right? Ronald Reagan and kind of everything he stands for. Soft power is generated from society, not from government. So what the Kremlin, through its intelligence agencies, is doing, and what China, through its Belt and Road and its Confucius Institutes, are doing in very different forms, are projections of state power and influence for strategic purposes. And those strategic purposes, broadly, are to weaken the West and enlarge their spheres of influence. Which is a problem for us because we have core allies within those spheres of influence. The cockpit of the world economy increasingly is Asia. And we learned with Imperial Japan what happens if a hostile power controls that economy and doesn't give us access to those markets and resources. So sharp power is the non-military projection of authoritarian influence.
Are tariffs sharp power?
No, I think tariffs are a blunt economic instrument for different purposes than.
I was trying to be ironic there. Did I succeed in being ironic?
Or no, they don't accomplish the objectives we would like them to accomplish. So the question of a contest of systems, there used to be a lot of skepticism in the West about this before Xi Jinping, who's now the Communist Party chief president of China.
For life.
He threw out term limits. He threw out rule by committee, which is what existed in the Communist Party leadership before him. He now argues essentially that there is a contest of systems and that China presents the developing world a very different model from the West, one in which you can be a political leader and build economic prosperity in your country, but you don't have to give up political power. And of course, this is very seductive to politicians in one-party systems, Azerbaijan, Rwanda, wherever it may be, who, of course, want to build economic development, modernize their economies, but do not want to have real political competition. And so China, in many ways, is a test case. I would argue China is actually quite unique. There are no other $1.4 billion countries with 5,000 years of history and kind of a bureaucracy that's almost as ancient. China is a centralized state in a way that no other country really has ever been. But the problem with
this— In an era of digital authoritarianism, which you know,
yes. So these—
Talk about that, because— To me, it's almost like if there was a moment to take a country with a population of over a billion people and experiment with some sort of, you know, Orwellian government, like, now's the time.
Now's the time. And because Chinese people essentially have zero rights to privacy, right? Because there is no Bill of Rights separating them from government control. The Chinese government and state-owned enterprises can collect the most extraordinary amount of data from these people. So the goal of the China total surveillance system, as articulated by Chinese leaders, is to be able to track the location of every single person inside China.
You gotta get points.
Within less than 2 seconds.
You gotta get points, right?
You have a social credit score.
Social credit score, right.
You know, these things are inconceivable in America. This idea that your fortunes in life would be tied to a score kept by some bureaucrat.
Take it through that. I mean, how deeply have you looked into this?
A social credit score is sort of, it's all sorts of things.
We had Mike Gallagher on, he was talking about it as well, but is it being applied and impacting people's lives today, or is this a kind of a plan as part of a, you know, 5-year?
It's a plan, yeah. But it's already affecting things like your ability to get a job, your ability to get government welfare benefits, your ability to get a permit to live in a city. Where the Chinese system has taken digital surveillance to the most Orwellian extreme is in Western China in Xinjiang, where they have built concentration camps with as many as 3 million Chinese citizens in them. This is a Muslim region of China.
Use the word concentration camps, okay? Tell me why that's the right language to use for what's going on.
It's a fine question. I'm not wedded to the term. These are enormous venues where citizens of that country are held without their consent and propagandized. So these are not people who are going to be killed, but they are subject to essentially a form of brainwashing, trying to eliminate their Muslim culture, their traditions, to try to basically forcibly turn them into Chinese citizens.
Is it 3 million?
It's as many as 3 million, according to the U.S. government. Yes, as many as. And it's very alarming because outside of those detention centers, camps, China has built a surveillance state to monitor the movements and behavior of every single one of these citizens in Western China because they are so worried that these people do not subscribe to one-party rule by the Communist Party in Eastern China.
So a lot of very interesting elements in your essay. One thing that I thought was highly provocative, yet subtle, was a point you make that forcibly detaining vast numbers of Chinese citizens in camps, we just hit on that, I'm quoting you, is not dissimilar as an abuse of government authority to the North Korean military's order to shoot on sight any citizens fleeing across the border into South Korea. I mean, you essentially put China in the category of a rogue state.
So, I mean, I think this goes to the point, which is that is the way the Chinese government treats its people a matter only for China? Or is it a matter for all of us? And arguably, it's a matter for all of us. In the 21st century, most countries are democracies. You essentially have a middle-class society emerging for the first time in human history. We have all these amazing technology tools, which have created boundless new possibilities. And yet, you have governments acting in ways that subvert the most basic rights of their people. I mean, the most basic liberties of their people, which is not simply the right to vote or politically participate. It's literally the right to exist and practice your religion, your faith, be with your family. And for everybody who thinks the Chinese model is so successful, the question I would ask them, China has the biggest army in the world, but China has more people.
There's a number.
Biggest armed forces in the world.
Yes.
Just the largest number of people in its armed forces. But it has more people working in the internal security services. Okay? So the question for Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders is, why are you so afraid of your own people?
What's the ratio, though? What's the ratio? Is it really kind of from a number of a billion people?
So it's vast. I mean, these technology tools obviously mean that you can control and surveil society without the same kind of human labor involved.
So I hear as you're describing this, we're going to just debate this a little bit more just to flesh out the arguments, not that I'm on the other side of this. But, you know, I could hear critics on the right, on the left saying, you know, probably this one from the left, in this country, we have way too many people in jail, right? Huge number of people in jail. How is that different than the Chinese, you know, approach to providing security for their people?
Right. So in this country, I mean, we have all sorts of rights, you know, habeas corpus and other rights. You are tried by a court of law. You are judged by an independent judge or a jury of your peers. I mean, it's a totally different process. Imagine if somebody swooped in right now to the Reagan Institute and took all of you away because your politics are different from the politics of the man currently
Impossible.
In power.
Everybody loves Reagan.
Imagine if somebody walked in here who was a state security agent, and essentially an FBI agent, and said, because you are not a Protestant Christian of this denomination, I am taking you and your family away. Right? That is actually what's happening in Xinjiang.
Good response. I want to move on to the competition of systems and debate that a little bit and really drill down. But we'll start on that side. From the security standpoint, very clear, there's military competition. Economic competition is playing out in a variety of different ways. You know, tariffs being in the trade disputes. Politically, in our systems, we have some of that, but it's not like this is the point of departure that the Trump administration, President Trump himself pursues. You make a point, though, that with respect to China, that then is now, I mentioned this before, no citizen flees a justly governed democracy. That's right. But in the U.S., we have thousands, tens of thousands of Chinese students. They all go home, right? That's on that front. On the economic sphere, we're trading with them. You know, second largest trading partner, part of the WTO. You know, there's a lot of aspects of this relationship that would suggest this really isn't a competition of systems. Wrestle with some of those questions and come out with the argument that you have in your
It's essay. A great question. I mean, I think all of us are just at the beginning of figuring out what to call this. But look, I think if there's a competition of systems, it's between our governments and forms of government. It's not between our peoples. I actually think it's a source of strength that Chinese students want to come to American universities, including, by the way, like the children of Xi Jinping, the leader, who were educated in American universities, right? There's a separate question for the United States. Almost all of these people go home because we have an immigration visa system that trains people up into world-class engineers, computer scientists, whatever it is, but then we don't actually
often let them stay.
So you're saying
giving them the opportunity, we would see what happened generations ago where almost China experiences a brain drain where these graduate students who have made, you know, amazing technical competencies would want to remain in the United States.
I mean, the history of America is immigrants who have come here, gotten educated or brought something particularly special and built amazing companies and been hugely successful. I mean, this is how Silicon Valley came into being, right?
True. Although in the case of the Indians, which is different entirely, they're going home.
Yeah, they're going home. But again, that's partly because it's very, very, they're going home to democracy and it's very, very difficult to stay. So I think part of the conversation about Chinese students, Indian students, others should be about wouldn't America benefit from having world-class talent that we have trained and educated, a little more of that staying here to build American companies, to pay American taxes, to contribute to our prosperity. That's just what highly skilled immigrants have done throughout American history, frankly. So I'm not sure why it would be different today. But there is also, as you say, our societies are very entangled, our economies are very entangled. In the tech era, the tech entanglement has become more dangerous because of the way the Chinese one-party state is using technology, not just to surveil its own people, but it is exporting those systems. It is building networks for, like, our NATO allies, our allies in Australia, elsewhere. These telecoms networks are innately vulnerable if a Chinese enterprise has constructed them, because Chinese enterprises always have Communist Party cells embedded in them and very strong ties to the Chinese state. And I think it's hard for us to understand. We think there's a public sector and a private sector, yeah, which is true in America, but it's not true in China, given that there is a Communist Party overlay.
I made this point once before, but it would be of interest, I think, to you. You know, Reagan went to China and gave a speech in Shanghai and Fudan University, and Mike Gallagher and Eric Edelman wrote essays on this. But the part that struck me about that speech is it was Reagan speaking to the people. And implicitly, it was, I'm speaking to, the day before he spoke to the Communist Party, but he wanted to speak to the people. And his message about America was, in America, the people rule, which is, of course, just listening to you, the most important distinction, perhaps, between the United States.
Of course, Reagan put it better than I did.
Yeah, well,
obviously.
You're almost a great communicator. He had that title. But I do think that as you look at American policy over the past, 30 years, we're speaking a lot to China's Communist Party, and probably less, not enough, to the Chinese people. And, as we think about how we work our way through this competition, I wonder, and that gets a little bit to what we were talking before with USIA, but speaking to the people needs to become more of a priority. But I'm going to just switch gears slightly and say, okay, we have this entanglement, as you reference it. I am now the CEO of, pick your favorite tech company whose market cap's $1 trillion, whatever, slot in Facebook, Google, whatever. And I'll bring in the president of IRI, right? And I want you to give me an approach to China, because from a business standpoint, to provide value to my shareholders, I got to be in that market. From reaching people, you want me in that market. What's my place in this competition?
So China has changed a lot in the last 20, 30 years. In the 90s and 2000s, lots of American, Western, Japanese, Korean, Taiwanese companies moved there, set up factories, used China's very low-cost mass manufacturing capability because of the suppression of labor rates to make lots of cheap stuff for export, which filled up Walmarts and Targets all over America. But those days are over. China's exports as a share of GDP have come way down. China is predominantly now about the Chinese market, not the external market. So if you're an American company, you're not going to be exporting out of China like you might have done 20 years ago, right? Because China's labor is now too expensive. And now you want to set up in Bangladesh or Vietnam or Ethiopia. So that's the first point. The second point is that setting up like a tech plant in China may be good for your quarterly earnings for the next few cycles, but it turns out that it can end your company. There's an acute amount of economic and political risk from sharing technology, embedding it in China, because it is invariably stolen, right? And so Motorola is a great example. In the late 90s, it had something like 80% of the global market in mobile phones, pre-smartphone. It's gone now. It doesn't exist. Its technology was stolen by China. Canada's primary internet service provider in the 2000s is literally gone, because the Chinese stole the commanding heights of its technology. It's out of business, right? So the argument to an American, which I've heard Marco Rubio make, Senator Rubio among others,
here at the Reagan Institute,
is that, of course, you want to sell into the Chinese market. Of course, you can do some business with China. Of course, it has all these consumers. But you are putting your actual company at risk if you share technology with Chinese partners, right? And it may be good for the next few quarters, but in 5 years, your company is gone.
So we'll have to follow up another conversation, because I think that answers the mail in terms of dealing with companies, which, as you noted, Chinese companies, which you can't really separate from the Chinese Communist Party. But if we take what you're saying to its logical endpoint, it would seem to suggest full-on separation, which wouldn't create the opportunities to connect with the people. But I'm going to take the last word there. It's going to move on to the next piece. We have just about 5 or 7 minutes left. I want to do two things. I want to talk about the piece of this that is probably the most important, but the part that you don't touch day to day as IRI, which is where the American people are on this question. And then we'll get to our lightning round. And the way I'm going to frame the question is this. The Reagan Institute did a national defense survey on how American people view all issues related to defense and national security and then countries, friends and allies. And 40% of those polled, which we call the American people, view China as a ally or friend, right? Friend or ally. I would venture to say, it wasn't a question in our survey, which we'll correct for the next one, that China enjoys more support from the American people than the support IRI or the NED would enjoy in terms of the United States engaging in democracy support around the world. Agree or disagree?
Disagree. Look, there's all sorts of polling. It depends how you ask the question. Obviously, if you ask Americans what are their top 10 priorities, they're not going to come up with supporting democracy in the world, right? But the Bush Institute, the Penn Biden Center, and Freedom House did some great polling about a year ago where they...
Yeah, Elliot Abrams pointed out to me.
Yes. It's super. And they basically, they came to the conclusion. Now, they weren't ranking democracy with 100 other things.
Correct.
But they came to the conclusion...
Choose, Social Security versus democracy.
Right.
Which wins?
That nearly 3 in 4 Americans believe that given a choice, we should support democracy in the world. That most people are not against doing that, right? That sort of it's an American thing to do. And secondly, 2/3 of Americans understand the link to our national security, that America is safer when the world is more democratic.
Which goes to the heart of I think, Reagan's outlook and why it was such a key piece. It's not the most important piece in terms of his Cold War strategy. You make a fantastic point in the essay where she's talking about America not being morally neutral, that we have to engage in this. But you kind of walk it back just a bit and you say, but support for democracy does not mean promoting revolutionary change in any kind of messianic fashion. And you go on to say that your view of Reagan's vision was democratic progress was had to be, you use the word evolutionary. Radical in its objective, evolutionary in its process, certainly not revolutionary. Talk about that. And I wonder now that we're, you know, approaching 20 plus years, we're approaching 20 years since 9/11, are we at a moment where we can get American people to think about democracy and promotion as evolutionary and not in the way you're describing before, which, you know, pick your favorite military unit to arrive at some sort of democratic outcome.
Democracy cannot be imposed by the barrel of a gun. So the way America does democracy support in the world is by supporting non-governmental organizations like IRI, like NDI, our sister Democratic Party Institute, to go out and work with political leaders, civil society leaders, other groups in other countries to empower them to level the playing field so that citizens can have an honest choice in those countries. And this is quite a great thing America does, because citizens may elect a government that isn't totally pro-American, but that's okay because we still feel more
often
confident.
Not the case.
We still feel much more confident when citizens elect a government that actually represents them. It turns out that government is accountable to those citizens and responsive to their concerns. And those citizens don't want to fight a war with the United States or send terrorists to blow us up. Those citizens want what those voters in Pakistan I talked about wanted, which is sort of more accountability, transparency, education, opportunity.
I like it, one, because I think it's right. Two, because I think it would appeal to the sentiments of most American people. I worry, though, that an era of belts and roads initiatives and authoritarian regimes that can move quickly and swiftly and leverage technology, is evolutionary approach here going to be fast enough?
So the thing about the revolutionary approach is that America, I mean, this was like a debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, right? Jefferson was a real revolutionary. But if you're going to run diplomatic relations with a bunch of countries, you can't also sponsor groups to go out and foment revolution in those countries. So there's always going to be a tension there. The Reagan quote, he said, look, we ask only that systems like the Soviets begin by living up to their own constitutions, abiding by their own laws, and complying with the international obligations they've undertaken. We ask only for a process, a direction, a basic code of decency, not for an instant transformation, right? So this is a way of speaking, I think, directly to Soviet citizens in his time, to citizens in Russia, China, other countries in our time, which is that your countries often do have constitutions that enumerate your rights, but your governments are not honoring them or abiding by them. And what we would like to see as Americans is a process that's not violent, that's peaceful, that opens your country up and makes it a better representative of its people. And it means it can have a better relationship with the United States, a real partnership with the United States, which we cannot have with a dictatorship that abuses its own people.
And doesn't follow its own rules.
Doesn't follow its own rules.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Let's go to our lightning round. Your favorite Reagan book?
I like Paul Leto's book about Reagan foreign policy and kind of the transformation in the 80s.
Nuclear weapons is pretty insightful. Yeah. Favorite Reagan speech? I dare say Westminster, but that would kind of just be not nice.
I must say I like The Boys at Pointe du Hoc a lot. Yeah. I like that one quite a lot, but there's lots of competition.
And your favorite Reagan quote?
My favorite Reagan quote, this is also tough. I will say, I have like a jokey version, which is his one about people always say hard work didn't kill anyone, but I figure why try. But I think I like his point. It would be cultural condescension or worse to say that any people prefer dictatorship to democracy, right? That the imperialistic thing to do is actually to say those Cubans, they don't actually want those Venezuelans, right? That's being an imperialist. It's cultural condescension, saying that's what's good for us. Freedom in the world is not good for other people. And the Reagan thing, it was universal because he understood that if you were for freedom and rights in America, you had to be for it everywhere.
Dan Twine, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for participating in our Reaganism podcast.
Thank you, Roger. Enjoyed it a lot.